From Texas to West Virginia, Minnesota to Louisiana, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, in June, the Supreme Court of the United States issued a landmark ruling in Janus v. AFSCME, upholding the right of workers not to be forced into supporting labor unions. Mark Janus is here to discuss his experience. Last-minute allegations have roiled the confirmation process for Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story on the impact on this year's midterm elections. The Cato Institute has issued its latest ranking of state-by-state economic competitiveness. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Chris Edwards of Cato. And today's college students don't have firsthand memories of the September 11, 2001 terror attacks. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College examines this new perspective on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. In what will go down in history as one of the most significant U.S. Supreme Court rulings, the High Court ruled it is a violation of workers' First Amendment constitutional rights to be forced into paying dues or fees to a labor union as a condition of employment. Mark Janus was the lead plaintiff in the suit, and today he is working to inform workers of their rights under the ruling. He joins us now to discuss. Mark, welcome to American Radio Journal. Mark, how did you become involved in this situation? What was it that you saw in the occupation you were in that prompted you to get involved in an issue such as this?
What happened was that when I worked for the state of Illinois in the 1980s, I was not represented by a union. I did not have to pay dues or fair share agency fees. I went into private business, and then when I returned to the state in 2007, I found out that I started paying, you know, this agency fee, which no one asked me if I wanted to pay it. I never signed a pledge card, never had any knowledge of it prior to my first paycheck, and here's this line item, it says union dues. And I just felt it was a violation. And here I was paying thousands of dollars over a decade to this political group, union, which I just did not agree with.
Tell us a little bit more for folks who may not be familiar with the term, Mark. What is an agency fee, and how does that differ from union dues?
Well, an agency fee is, it varies across the country, but an agency fee is, in my case, was approximately 80% of full union dues. And the argument was that because the union is representing me in a collective bargaining area, they felt that they needed this money in order to represent me under the collective bargaining agreement. But here's the crux of the matter. The unions went into, you know, whatever entity they negotiate with, and they asked for that exclusive monopoly representation. It was at their request. And when I found out that I didn't have any freedom of association, which is guaranteed to me and every other citizen in this country under their First Amendment rights, I just felt that it was a violation. So I found the Liberty Justice Center, who is a public interest law firm, and they fight for a cause and not for the dollars. And after some dialogue and discussion, they agreed to take the case, and the rest, as they say, is history.
So here you were, having to pay an agency fee, having to pay what unions in a misnomer call a fair share fee. You're having to pay all this money to the labor union, which you did not ask to be represented by, which you did not wish to associate with. Now you have your case and you're getting set to go into court. At that point, knowing that you're going to be fighting organized labor, not just at your local level, but at the national level, tell us a little bit about that experience. What was it like knowing what it was that you were about to go up against?
Well, it was quite frankly overwhelming, because when we finally did make it to the Supreme Court and they agreed to accept our case, it was just unbelievable and humbling, because here's your name on the docket. And as a friend of mine back home told me, he said, you know, you're going to become a verb. Well, I'd never thought of it in that way. And, you know, like Brown versus Board of Education, Harris versus Quinn and some of these other monumental cases, Miranda, et cetera. You don't think in those terms until it really begins to happen and it's kind of thrust upon you.
Talk a little bit then about your experience going through the legal process. You started out, I'm sure, in a lower court and then ended up before the Supreme Court of the United States. Tell us a little bit about how that unfolded and what the experience was like when you actually got to the Supreme Court and you had oral arguments and you're there before the nine justices.
This is not like your TV courtroom. I sat in the gallery with my daughter and other people, and just like everybody else does, you know, if you're a tourist, you can walk in and if you get a ticket, you can hear the case being argued. It's primarily my attorney, Bill Messenger, who was with Right to Work Foundation, and Jacob Hubert, who was representing me under Liberty Justice. And, you know, it's basically a debate between the justices and the attorneys. And each side gets, you know, an appropriate amount of time. And then the argument's over and, you know, and then they make a decision and they render their decision.
What sort of experience did you have with the labor unions, Mark? Of course, this was an issue that they fought with every fiber of their being. Were you in any way mistreated during the process? I'm sure you were subject to a lot of verbal attacks. And how did you respond to that level of criticism, although you also had a lot of people supporting you? And you might want to talk a bit about that as well.
Obviously, the unions are going to push back and they're going to think, you know, that this is negative. But the point that I like to make is nowhere in our argument when we filed or in the decision does it say that unions are going to cease to exist. Nowhere does it say that collective bargaining is going to end. And nowhere does it say that unions are going to fall off the edge of the earth. And I point to the federal side of the government where they have not had to pay fair share fees for years. And on the federal side, they still have unions, they still negotiate, they still collective bargaining. However, you have, I was in Minnesota a few days ago, and we had Teamsters out front protesting, saying, stop the war on workers. And I'm looking around saying, where's the war? There is no war on workers. All we're doing is giving workers the choice and the freedom to make their own decision under their First Amendment right, just like every other citizen in the United States. And why is that so scary for them?
Sounds to me like you view this more as a worker freedom issue than an anti-union issue.
It's not an anti-union issue. It's never been an anti-union position. It never has. However, unfortunately, the public sector unions are framing it that way. And why, I don't understand, other than the fact that they've had a monopoly for so many years and they have been able to collect these fees, millions of dollars across countless millions of public sector workers for years. And now all of a sudden, that money is going to dry up. People can make their own decision and they can decide for themselves what they want to do. And I think that's what scares them the most, the fact that people are going to wake up and they're going to realize, I don't have to do this anymore. You know, I'm free to make my own decision under the First Amendment and that freedom of association. And whenever you talk to the union folks and their representatives or leadership, nowhere do they ever bring up the fact that this is a First Amendment freedom of association issue. They tell you that you're going to lose your pension. That's false. They tell you that you're not going to be covered under the contract. That's false. And every other argument they make, it's abominable. What we're hearing, and that's why I'm out speaking to groups, traveling across the country. That's why I was in Philly yesterday. That's why I'm in Pittsburgh today, talking to you and so many other people across the country.
We have been talking with Mark Janus, who was the plaintiff in a landmark United States Supreme Court ruling, Janus v. AFSCME. Mark, thank you for coming on American Radio Journal to explain how this ruling came about and what workers' rights have now been affirmed by the court.
You're welcome. And people do want information. I do have a website out there called standwithworkers.org. And they can go to that website, and we'll be more than happy that we've got a bunch of FAQs. And if they're having difficulty and they want our assistance, you know, send us an email, and we will contact them, and we'll try to point them in the right direction so that they can choose and make their own decision.
Standwithworkers.org. Mark Janus,
correct.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth in Washington, D.C., which has been always an interesting place to be, but certainly this past week. Andy, good to have you here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
The nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court of the United States, of course, has been roiled by allegations thus far unproven, and it has at least temporarily delayed the process for confirmation. So, Andy, let's talk a little bit today about the political equation here, because as with anything and everything that happens in Washington, there are political ramifications to this. How does this affect particularly those Democrats who are up for re-election to the U.S. Senate this year in states carried by Trump? How does it affect their re-election chances?
With this woman coming forward and making these allegations, the Democrats now have an excuse. Regardless of whether the allegations are true or not, they have planted enough doubt into people's minds. Presumably, we haven't seen any polling, but presumably they've planted enough doubt into voters' minds where Senate Democrats in Trump states now have an excuse to vote no on Kavanaugh's confirmation. The good news is that Republicans still have a majority. They have 51 votes, and it appears that the Republicans who might be most willing to side with the Democrats, people like Jeff Flake and Susan Collins, are now, I think, siding with Kavanaugh because of the woman's insistence on not testifying or not wanting to or not providing an answer as to whether she'll testify. I think people think that something fishy is going on. So it appears that Kavanaugh will, at this moment, get voted on. It appears that he will have the votes. What's in question is what the Senate Democrats will do. One of them has already announced her intentions. Claire McCaskill, senator from Missouri, has said that she's voting no. It's unclear whether that will harm her politically. That race in Missouri is very tight. I bet that the next round of polls that come out will be very informative on this. And those polls may come out in time to inform the other Senate Democrats who are still on the fence. So it'll be a fascinating next few days to see where these Senate Democrats go. I will note, though, is that Kavanaugh will either get 49 votes, which means that a couple Republicans say no and that the nomination fails, or it's likely that he'll get like 54 votes. But it seems unlikely to me that he'll get just 51, which is all Republicans. I think some of these Senate Democrats, if they see that the nomination is going to happen, they may make a political calculation and vote yes, because they can say that they weren't the deciding vote, but that they saw all the evidence about the allegations. They saw Kavanaugh's qualifications to be a justice, and they made the decision and decided to vote yes. So my guess is that whatever happens, Kavanaugh's not going to get 51 votes, but we'll see.
As we look at this, there are, of course, a number of Republicans up for re-election to the U.S. Senate this year. Does a yes vote for Kavanaugh endanger them in any way and open them to attack from the Democrats? Because, of course, the Democrats will accuse them of not being sympathetic, et cetera, et cetera.
The funny thing is there's been a little bit of polling about Kavanaugh, and it may not come as a surprise, but it breaks along party lines. Republicans are for Kavanaugh, Democrats are against, and there's very, 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 very little crossover. So I think the question is, comes down to voter intensity, voter enthusiasm. Democrats clearly more enthusiastic to vote this year than Republicans are, at least at this moment. Trump, of course, has the ability to get these Republicans to come out and vote again, or at least we think he does. And then of course, where are these independent voters? Where are they going to go? I think independent voters are more likely to side with Trump if you're in a more rural state or district. So perhaps in Arizona, the Republican can prevail there and save that seat. Nevada, maybe. It's unclear just because the population centers mainly down in the south in Vegas or Lake Tahoe. But yeah, the Kavanaugh issue is very partisan, and the swing voters, independent voters, I think it depends on where they're located as to whether which side of the aisle they'll break.
And, of course, while all eyes are on this, we do have the budget process moving forward, or actually what appears to be a continuing resolution process, the deadline for the new federal budget being October 1st. So, Andy, some action in the Senate this past week?
Yeah, some history is required here. As your listeners may recall, back in March, Republicans and Democrats shut down the government oh so briefly over the budget and over immigration and paying for the wall and that sort of thing. But in March, they finally cobbled together a deal and sent it to Trump. When Trump looked at it, he was appalled by it, by how big and nasty it was. And so he threatened to veto it. He ultimately signed it, but he said he was never going to sign another one of those again. So between March and now, that veto threat's kind of always been looming out there. Well, congressional Republicans have put in a lot of spade work to try and avoid that, but there are still too many in the party, and there are still too many Democrats who want to spend even more, despite the fact that we are very soon going to experience perpetual and annual trillion-dollar deficits. So congressional Republicans try to live under Trump's wishes and try to keep spending at bay, but they kept meeting resistance from people within their own party and the Democrats. And in Washington, when you have an inability to compromise by, we'll take some of our priorities, we'll take some of your priorities, but not everything, that's no longer the case in D.C. What is the case is that all differences are settled by just spending billions and billions more than what either party wanted. So everybody wins except the taxpayer. And that's what happened this past week. They had a conference report with a huge spending bill, part not the entire budget, but a large chunk of the budget. It was $10.7 billion more than what the Trump administration had wanted, but they cobbled it together and they voted it on in the Senate. It passed 93-7. There were only seven brave souls who recognized how bad it was. So it now goes on to the House. It's unclear if the House has the votes to pass it. But then if they do, then it goes on to Trump. And I got to tell you, it's really unclear what he's going to do. It has defense spending in there, which is important to the president, but it does not have border wall funding or a lot of other of his priorities. So we'll see what happens.
And, of course, we will continue to keep an eye on this with Andy Roth from the Club for Growth. Andy, a couple of words about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C., but we have over 250,000 members from all across the country, from all walks of life, and we're united because we believe in economic freedom. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org, and if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Economic competitiveness varies from state to state. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details on the Cato Institute's new ranking of the states from Chris Edwards. Eric?
Speaking from personal experience, I can tell you that moving is no fun at all. In the past 12 months, I've had to move myself. I've helped my brother move. I've helped my parents move. It is just not something you want to do often. But lots of Americans move for lots of reasons every single year. And when you put all those moves together, you look at that data collectively, you start to see some interesting trends. And we're going to talk about one of those trends today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Chris Edwards. He is an economist at the Cato Institute and the editor of Cato's Downsizing Government Project. That's downsizinggovernment.org. And Chris joins us today to talk about one of these interesting trends about where Americans move. Chris, thanks for taking some time and being here on the show.
Hey, thanks a lot, Eric.
So one of the things that you guys look at Cato, and this is something actually a joint effort of scholars at Cato and a number of other free market think tanks, you look at this IRS data that gets released every year on all the moves that Americans made between states across the entire country. And what you've found is that looking at the data for 2016, there were about 600,000 people who made there was something in common about the move that they made. They went from a high tax state, a relatively higher tax state, to a relatively lower tax state. Tell us a bit about this data.
people move from, they pick up their possessions and they move to other states for a variety of reasons, maybe jobs, maybe they're retiring. Some folks on the political left have looked at this and they say, well, no, it's not taxes. They're moving to Florida for the nice weather and the sun. But after looking at the data in detail, I think it's pretty clear if you look at the patterns of where people are moving from and to, that taxes play a significant role. I looked at the inflows and outflows from every state, and you can sort of see whether states are on net losing people or gaining people each year. The biggest losers are states like New York, Connecticut, California, New Jersey. These are high-tax states. The biggest gainers are places like Florida, Arizona, Texas. These are generally low-tax states. So one thing I did is I divided the 50 states between the 25 highest-tax states and the 25 lowest-tax states. It turns out that of the 25 highest-tax states, 24 of them had net out-migration in 2016, which is kind of remarkable. So they're not just flowing out of cold places in the Northeast, they're flowing out of other states that have high taxes. And where are they flowing to? They're flowing to low-tax states. And those low-tax states are not just warm places like Florida. South Dakota is an interesting example. South Dakota is a low-tax state with no income tax. It has net inflows consistently. Another interesting example is New Hampshire. It's up in the Northeast, but it's a low-tax state with no income tax. People are flowing in, but they're flowing out of its neighbor, high-tax Massachusetts. Tennessee and Kentucky are an interesting pair. For many years, Tennessee has been enjoying net inflows. Kentucky suffers from net outflows. Kentucky is a high-tax state. It is not a right-to-work state. Tennessee is a right-to-work state, and it has very low taxes and no income tax. So when you start looking at these pairs of states across the country, you can see these patterns pretty clearly.
And to put these migration patterns and these numbers in context, Chris, we really have to talk about something that was included in the tax bill last year, something that our listeners may have heard of, something called the SALT deduction. This is the state and local tax deduction. If you live in a high tax state, a state with high state and local taxes, you're probably very much aware of this thing. It used to allow you, before the tax bill that was passed last year, you used to be able to deduct all of your state and local taxes out of your federal tax bill. So it kind of softened the blow of living in a place like New York or Massachusetts, for example. That deduction is now capped going forward. And so that is, it's a blow to people who live in higher tax states. They're going to now have to pay the full value of their state taxes, and they're also going to have to pay a larger share. They're going to get to deduct less out of their federal taxes. So you've got some blue state governors like Andrew Cuomo, for example, who is very upset about this, thinks that this is unfair to his state. I tend to think of it kind of the other way around, that it was more unfair under the old system. Do you think this is going to change the way people will decide to move and where they choose to live and how they vote with their feet?
The data I looked at all happened before the big change in tax law last year in 2017 under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. The Republicans capped the so-called SALT deduction, as you mentioned. That is going to increase the tax pain for 25 million households, mainly higher income households, of living in high tax states like California and New York and Connecticut and New Jersey. Those states either have high income taxes or high property taxes or both. And under the new tax law, those households will not be able to deduct the high taxes they pay. So they're going to face the full brunt of the burden of those high taxes. And I think at the margin, that's going to induce more people, especially high earners, to think about moving to one of the lower tax states, whether it's Texas or Florida or North Carolina, somewhere like that. I think it's going to have a substantial effect. Governors in high tax states, as you mentioned, like Cuomo in New York, they're not happy about it, but ultimately they're going to have to respond as more people move out of those states. Those states, the smart move for them would be to make their governments more efficient to bring those tax rates down. So we'll see what's going to happen.
Yeah, and certainly moving from place to place is not easy. But if you're wealthy, if you're the type of person that will be affected by the cap on the SALT deduction, you now have another incentive to take your money somewhere else, take your money somewhere where the government will take less of it. That is Chris Edwards, an economist with the Cato Institute. Chris, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Thank you.
And again, Chris Edwards is an economist at the Cato Institute. He's also the director of Cato's DownsizingGovernment.org project. You can check out his work at Cato.org or, of course, at DownsizingGovernment.org. Check out our work at Reason.com. And for Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Bain. We'll catch you right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
17 years after the September 11, 2001 terror attacks, a new generation of Americans is coming of age who did not experience that day. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College talks about the impact on this American Radio Journal commentary.
This year's remembrances of September 11, 2001 were odd for me. Consider, did you ever think you'd live to see a time when the new generation doesn't remember 9/11? Well, I've reached that point with my students. For 20 years, every fall semester, I've taught Middle East politics at Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania. In the late 1990s and into my syllabus for the fall 2001 semester, I included a lecture on some grisly fellow named Osama bin Laden and an attempt to blow up one of the World Trade Center buildings back in 1993. I wanted my students to know about this diabolical terrorist who ought to be on their radar. The events of the morning of September 11, 2001, my class would actually meet later that afternoon, took care of that. Osama and his minions were on our radar, loud and clear. My students and every student got a quick tutorial on the sinister Osama dude. But as for my students this current semester, fall 2018, well, the course has finally reached a point where none remember 9/11. I asked them how many recall the horrors of that morning. I got a room full of blank stares, and I'm pretty sure that one of the freshmen was actually born after September 11, 2001. Imagine that. Think about trying to teach what had to be lived to fully comprehend. How do you teach it? How do you memorialize it? One place that tries is the Flight 93 Memorial in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. I stopped there last March for the first time while off the Pennsylvania Turnpike, taking a different route home from Washington, D.C., which just happened to be the destination of Flight 93. The people on that plane stopped a catastrophe in the nation's capital, where the aircraft was on its way to the Capitol Dome or the White House. The day I stopped by was windy and bitter cold. I walked along complaining to myself about the chill. It was a stupidly selfish reaction in the face of what those victims had endured and sacrificed in 2001. Few visitors that day were there that cold afternoon, and the actual exhibition center was closed. I walked to the overlook, and I glimpsed where the plane hit. It's a strange experience. You expect something dramatic, eerie, a ghastly crater of some nasty sort that oozes blood from the ground. But it's not like that. If you were flying over the area today, you'd never even know the spot was anything but a farmer's field. It's amazing how our Earth mundanely absorbs something like that, literally barely a dent. I told a friend about my visit. He had been there before, and he was disappointed. He told me, quote, "I wanted to leave that place mad with righteous indignation," unquote. He wants young people who visit, who didn't live through 9/11, to come away with that feeling. Well, hate and rage aren't good things, but anger, properly placed, especially in light of what happened that morning 17 years ago, is understandable, perhaps even necessary, critical. Young people need to know that what transpired was pure evil. Evil does exist. It has been on the prowl since the dawn of humanity, and few modern moments embody that reality so obviously as September 11, 2001. Remember that and teach that. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Check out my latest book, A Pope and a President, on John Paul II and Ronald Reagan, and check out our website, the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KFBX-AM in Fairbanks, Alaska, WRAK-AM in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, along with WSOY-AM in Decatur, Illinois. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.